And welcome back to Tuesday's Topical Currents. Thanks for joining us. I'm Bonnie Berman. Joseph Cooper is on vacation. The title of Gary Steingart's new book, Little Failure, comes from his mother's nickname for him. Neither of Steingart's parents thought he would amount to much, but he proved them wrong. The author of three highly acclaimed novels, including the recent bestseller Super Sad True Love Story, he's recognized as a brilliant satirist with an unfailing eye for the foibles of modern American life. But now, in Little Failure, he's written a memoir about himself and his parents, dissident Jews who fled to the United States from the Soviet Union in the 1970s. They settled in Queens, where Steingart's heavy accent and nerdy demeanor consigned him to outsider status. But his imagination helped him to escape into a world of his own making. Literary contributor Ariel Gonzalez spoke with Steingart. He began by asking him if his disapproving parents have finally come to terms with his success.
I think they're proud of me. I sometimes feel that the work I do is a little different from their political and other points of views. So we don't agree exactly on everything at the dinner table, but I think they're proud of me because, I mean, they've always wanted me to pursue a more professional career than writer. My mother always used to ask, but who are you by profession? You know, and writer doesn't really make the grade. But I think, you know, now that I can support myself, and I think they're pretty impressed by that.
Well, your parents haven't always been encouraging or understanding. Tell us about the scene in your memoir where you and your parents are having a meal and your father brings up the Russian internet or whatever that is.
We're having a birthday meal for my mother at the Marriott Marquis revolving restaurant in Times Square. And my father says, I just read in the Russian internet that you will soon be forgotten. And then he quotes some obscure person in some provincial town who thinks I'll soon be forgotten. And my novels, too, you know. And then he pulled out a ranking of writers that just came out. And he said, and look, you were ranked below David Remnick, who's the editor of The New Yorker.
Who's a nonfiction writer.
Who's a nonfiction writer, well, but, you know.
Still.
And then he listed some other people I was below. So, you know, just a happy little meal with his parents.
With some belittlement, just a little bit.
Yeah.
Then there's your mother. She didn't like your first novel, The Russian Debutante's Handbook. What did she object to?
Well, it's not that she didn't like it. I think that there was a review in some Jewish newspaper that suggested that she was sort of like the main character in the book, the mother character in the book. I think this was also a problem. I mean, one of the problems is that their English is not spectacular. It's pretty good, but it's functional. So sometimes they don't get the nuances of things, which is why I always wait for them to read the Russian version of whatever I write. But they do have often difficulty with, especially since, you know, this memoir maybe is an exception, but I usually write in a kind of ironic mode. And that is not easily translated. They don't know when the joke is happening.
We're speaking with Gary Steingart, whose latest book is a memoir entitled Little Failure. What's been their reaction to this memoir?
Well, they haven't read it yet, so you know. So I'm ahead of the curve for now.
Didn't give them an advance copy?
I did send them about a week before the publication. I sent them a copy, but I haven't heard about it since. So
they've been silent.
They've been silent about it, yeah.
Well, your mother is responsible for the title.
She is. Little Failure was her moniker for me. The way I remember it is I graduated from Oberlin College, where I'd majored in, I don't know, politics, you know, just to please them. But I'd taken classes in the Beatles and whatnot. It was a wonderful sort of Marxist-Leninist hippie education. And so my mother at least expected that after they spent $100,000 on that place that I would go to law school. I mean, that was the idea. That's why I took politics as a major. And then I said, you know, I'm going to become a writer. So it was like a coming out, you know, as a writer. And I lived in the Lower East Side of Manhattan, and that was before it was gentrified. And I lived in this 100-square-foot apartment, completely sloped floor. There was a water bug in there big enough to be my roommate, you know. And my mother walked up, and she looked around, and, you know, she said, are you going to law school? I said, no. And she said, you really are a little failure. And she used the kind of combination of English and Russian, failure-chka. So it's a diminutive, using the Russian chka, diminutive of the English word failure. So she was very creative. I mean, one of the lucky things I have is everything they say is so memorable. And so, you know, when it came time to writing this memoir, and they were a big part of it, all of their sayings just trickled in. And whenever they say something, I would run to the bathroom and write it down. And now I just type it on my iPhone. It's spectacular stuff.
Your parents come from different walks of Russian life. What were their backgrounds like? And how is Stalin, the Soviet dictator, responsible for the two branches of your family coming together?
Well, I mean, in some ways, Hitler and Stalin conspired to make sure that all the Jews who grew up on my father's side in the Ukraine and my mother's side in what's now Belarusia back then. On my father's side, Stalin's era saw huge hunger in that part of the world, and anybody who could get out would go to Moscow or Leningrad. So my father's folks ended up in Leningrad. My mother's side, the Holocaust pretty much cleared the entire family off the face of the earth. My grandmother was one of the few people that was still alive, and she had made it to Leningrad. So, you know, just those two. I mean, I think at one point when I'm listing all the people at the dinner table, Hitler and Stalin definitely have a kind of place there, because they were uniquely responsible, not just for my family, but for millions of Soviet families coming together, and especially Soviet Jewish families, because Hitler took care of that part as well.
I was moved by the story of your great uncle, Aaron.
Yeah.
Please tell it to us.
Well, a fascinating story, you know, and not atypical. So when he was just a teenager, the Germans invaded the little village in Belarus where he lived, and he saw his whole family killed before his eyes, and then he managed to escape. He was just a kid, and he ran through the fields of snow, missing a shoe, and then he was taken up by the Red Army partisan unit. And then he joined the Red Army proper, and he made it all the way to Berlin as a soldier. And then he said he did a few things wrong. He praised a German tank, the technology, which was against the law. You couldn't praise German technology. And he also wrote a poem that I think one of his commanders thought he was hitting on his girlfriend, the commander's girlfriend. So all of this landed him in Siberia with about a 10-year sentence in Siberia. And so, you know, he was a kid who's watched his family die in front of his eyes by the Germans, killed by the Germans, ends up in Berlin, part of the conquering army, part of the army that saved Europe, and if you want to go further than that, saved the whole free world. And his reward for all of his, for all the battles he fought was 10 years of hard labor. And last I heard, I think he's in Boston or something. So
he's in the United States?
I think he was. He emigrated, yes. Okay. So, you know, a happy ending, but with a lot of bizarre...
But it's also, well, that story is just the way that his parents or his family died, because he had a handicapped sister.
Right.
And the parents told him, leave, flee,
save yourself.
Yeah. But we could save ourselves, but... we don't want your sister to die alone.
Right. They didn't want the sister to die alone. So when the Germans invaded that village, they stayed with her, and they were all shot. Mm. And he was in an attic watching it happen.
And he watched it.
And he saw it happen.
Yeah. Wow.
So, you know, and then, you know, on my father's side, my father's first four memories are hiding under the train that was evacuating them from Leningrad as the German bombers came in. His best friend of his, you know, he was 3-5 years old. His best friend died of some malnutrition or disease or whatever. But, you know, his sister jumped out of a window pursued by rats because the rats were trying to eat any kid they could find. And then somebody came to his door and said, your father died. He was a soldier outside. They were trying to break through the lines of German troops surrounding Leningrad. There was that long siege of Leningrad. So, you know, that's how he grew up. Before he was even 5, all these things happened. So when I write about my parents, you know, the part of this book is a kind of excavation of their histories to try to understand what made them the kind of people they are. And the book is a kind of difficult love letter to them in the sense that they did the best they can, but the people they are was so influenced by, the people they became was incredibly influenced by the tides of history. And not just Hitler and Stalin, but growing up in a system as inhuman as the Soviet Union was. It was never as inhuman as it was under Stalin, but it never quite became, you know,
Denmark. It wasn't a paradise.
It wasn't a paradise.
Yeah.
It was not a paradise.
Well, we're speaking with Gary Steingart, whose new book is a memoir entitled Little Failure. You were born in 1972.
Yeah.
Your parents fled to the United States in 1978.
79. Well, yeah, they left 78 and we got here in 79.
Okay. Right. They were grain Jews.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Well, there was a lot of agitation on behalf of American Jews to get all the Soviet Jews out of Russia, out of the Soviet Union. And there was a lot of difficulty with that because who wants to let go of their Jews? They're all mechanical engineers and whatnot, you know. But after a bad harvest in the Soviet Union, Brezhnev and Jimmy Carter came to an agreement where tens of thousands, almost 100,000 Jews were exchanged for millions of tons of grain and also some high technology. So I was basically bartered for, you know, 300 rolls of bread and a croissant or something, you know, if you think of it that way. Very strange, the late 70s.
So Jimmy Carter did something right.
I think so. I mean, you know, Soviet Jews are very conservative, and there's a lot of, they were very happy when Reagan was elected, obviously. But when you look at it, you know, it was really Jimmy's actions that led us in a big way to this country.
But your parents weren't politically active in Russia, were they?
They were vaguely. I mean, my father, you know, would, he was very into Judaism, so he would go to the synagogue and he would sort of, they would march outside the synagogue chanting, "We are Jews," which was not a cool thing to do in the,
because there was a lot of anti-Semitism in Russia.
Sure. A lot of it took, I mean, there was always anti-Semitism in Russia, but a lot of it was a result of Israel's victory in the Six-Day War in 67. That's when things were really, really ramped up. The Soviet Union obviously sided with its Arabs, with the Arab states, and so Jews did find themselves in a bad position.
We need to take a break. When we return, we'll continue speaking with Gary Steingart. This is Ariel Gonzalez, and you're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Welcome back. This is Ariel Gonzalez, and you're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Our guest today is best-selling author Gary Steingart. Mr. Steingart is known for satirical novels such as Absurdistan and Super Sad True Love Story. But his new book is a memoir about his life in his native Russia and the United States. It's called Little Failure. You and your parents arrived in the United States in 1979. You settled in Queens. Was there a Russian Jewish exile community there?
There was starting to be one. I mean, the major community that people know of in New York was Brighton Beach for Russian Jews. There was one in Regal Park in Forest Hills where my grandmother ended up, where we were not so much. We lived in Kew Gardens and then Little Neck, which had absolutely no Russian Jews whatsoever. My parents didn't want me to be surrounded by our own kind. But at the same time, they spoke only Russian at home. They wanted to assimilate, obviously, and they wanted me to be, you know, surrounded by jovial Americans. But at the same time, in the house, they wanted me to preserve Russia. And this kind of split also extended to other things. So culturally, Russian literature and Russian art and music were considered superior. But at the same time, America as a country was considered far superior. Capitalism was considered far superior. So I never quite knew where I stood, you know.
You were schizophrenic.
It was schizophrenic in the sense that, you know, earn as much money as you can, but at the same time, don't watch TV. We didn't have a TV. You know, read your Chekhov and your Dostoevsky.
Not long after you settled in, your parents thought they had struck it rich. Tell us about the letter they received congratulating them on winning a fortune.
Well, we get a letter and, you know, we're so naive. We're used to, you know, in the Soviet Union, the government's always lying to you. Everyone's always lying to you. All of a sudden, but we think in America, everything has to be above board, you know. So we get a letter that says, Mr. Steingart, so to speak, you have just won $10 million, you know, and it's the Publisher Clearinghouse. And we were convinced that this was it. This was the beginning of an incredible, I mean, I remember thinking, do we just move to Miami now and buy a waterfront mansion? And, you know, I was already planning the boat I was going to have and all these different things. And so we submitted, you know, all the forms. And one of the things you had to, you know, you would get your $10 million, but first you had to subscribe to 5 national magazines. So we dutifully did that, subscribed to Motor Trend, Car and Motor, Motor and Driver, Car and Carburetor, whatever, you know. And then at work, my parents were told that, you know, everyone gets these letters and nobody really wins that $10 million. So it was crushing, you know. I thought, what the heck, you know.
Well, those guys later got sued for that.
Oh, they did?
Yeah, they did.
It was a
big kind of scam. They They got sued and had to pay out millions of dollars.
Really?
In settlement. Yeah, Publishers Clearinghouse.
Well, I want to join that class action suit because I feel like they broke our hearts, you know.
Well, yeah, because a lot, there were people who really believed it.
And weirdly enough, you know, just a couple of months ago, I was watching the movie Nebraska, which is predicated on the same thing.
Yes, it is.
And I was thinking, but it's an older American gentleman. I thought even the native born fall for this kind of stuff. So I felt a little better about our naivete there.
Our guest today is Gary Steingart, whose latest book is a memoir entitled Little Failure. Even though you lived in Queens, your father was determined that you be exposed to culture. And culture to him was not just anything Russian, it was also anything French. So one day he took you to see a French movie.
Yes.
What happened?
Well, it was quite a French film. It was called Emmanuel, The Joys of a Woman. It was an X-rated film that they showed that was shown on Main Street in Flushing, which was a very, you know, it wasn't like an X-rated theater. They just happened to have, things were a lot more Catholic back then, and with a small C, in the sense that, you know, you could watch Popeye and Emmanuel on the same screen. So we walked in, and this was not quite, you know, it was not about Voltaire, let's say, or about Versailles. It was set in a boarding school in Hong Kong and then a brothel in Macau. And Emmanuel was this French, although later I learned she was Dutch, a porn star, really. And so most of the movie, my father kept his hand clasped firmly to my eyes as I spied about seven female genitalia, which, as I wrote in the book, is seven more than I would see for a very long time. but it made a very big impression on me.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Your birth name is Igor, not Gary. Your parents Americanized your name so you could fit in, but it didn't work. You had a lot of trouble fitting in, didn't you?
Yeah. Igor, we decided, sounded too much like Frankenstein's assistant, so we decided to try for something American. Gary Cooper is a big hit among Russians, so we went for that. No, it was terrible. I mean, this was the Reagan era of the, you know, the evil empire and all those movies, Red Dawn, you know, Red Gerbil, Red Hamster, whatever, you know. So yeah, the kids would scream Rusky and Commie, and my father was very surprised. He thought, you know, we were sending you to a Hebrew school, so everyone's going to love you because they'll be your fellow Jews. But he didn't quite understand that I would be pegged as a Russian.
You were more Russian than Jewish.
Well, to those kids, I was just Russian. You know, I mean, Jewish, who cares? Everybody's Jewish. But to them, I was Russian. And to the point where I started to pretend to the kids that I wasn't born in Leningrad. I was born in East Berlin. So there I was in a Hebrew school pretending to Jewish kids that I'm a German, which was considered better than being a Russian at that point.
Wow.
Because the Russians were about to bomb us, you know.
Well, when did you lose your accent? Because you had a pretty heavy accent.
I would say about 14, something like that, 13, 14, around bar mitzvah age, maybe a little around then. It was hard for me because, as I said, we spoke only English in the house. And so I would practice quite a bit, practice in front of the mirror. Words like, we had a little garden apartment which had an attic. I was very proud of our attic, but it kept coming out as addict when I said it. So making sure, once I got attic right, things really, it was all pretty good after that.
The actor Paul Giamatti is a friend of yours. He appeared in a trailer for your last novel, Super Sad True Love Story. He's playing a Russian villain in the new Spider-Man movie. Did you give him any pointers on the accent?
No. That's a funny question. Giamatti's so incredible that no matter what you setting you put him in, he can do anything. So I haven't seen the new movie, but anything with him, even though Spider-Man is not exactly up my creek, I will definitely watch him in it. They're trying to adapt Super Sad as a TV series now.
Really?
Yeah.
A miniseries or?
No, a television series. That's the dream. So I would love to cast him in that if possible.
That's interesting.
But I wonder who he would play. I mean, he could play Lenny, you know. And,
yeah.
And someone like James Franco could play Joshy, even though Joshy's older than Lenny. Well, yeah. You
know. Okay. Despite all the problems you had, your imagination did turn things around. How did writing science fiction win you some popularity?
Well, I would read one of the magazines we subscribed to with the Publisher's Clearinghouse debacle was Isaac Asimov's Science Fiction magazine, which was a very nerdy, you know, very hard science kind of magazine. But I loved it as a kid. And even though my English wasn't perfect, something about reading about other worlds just fit right in with my mentality. I felt like I was living in another world after we'd moved to America. I felt like New York in circa 1980 was science fiction, you know. So I started to write my own science fiction little stories. And one of the, there was a very kindly substitute teacher, and she liked me quite a bit. And she designated sort of every the end of every period as, you know, Gary novel hour, where I would, or novel 10 minutes, or I would read an excerpt from it in my accented English. And the kids loved it. And my, this is sort of where I became less of this crazy Russian guy in a big fur coat and more of, oh, you know, Gary tells stories. And then I wrote a satire of the Torah called the Genora, with, you know, Exodus became Sexodus and stuff like that. And the kids loved that satire because it was, a, you know, it was your typical yeshiva where the rabbis just yell stuff you don't quite understand all day long, you know, the Talmud and et cetera. And this was a kind of satire on it. And the kids became my friends. They were nerdy friends, to be sure. They weren't, you know, the popular kids, but they were somebody, you know.
Yeah. We're speaking with Gary Steingart about his memoir, Little Failure. You said that there was no TV at your house, but TV did have an influence on you. You write that your family thought the TV Guide was America's version of literature.
Right.
So when did you watch it? How did you watch it?
Yeah, we went, yeah, from Hemingway to the TV Guide as the great sort of American classics. My grandmother had a TV that, a Zenith that was probably one of the first Zeniths ever made. And it was in this giant wooden cabinet, and it could either catch picture or sound. That was the problem with it. And so I would, after Hebrew school, I would go to her house for a couple of hours while my parents were still working. And so I would watch something for an hour. Let's say it was, you know, Buck Rogers in the 25th century. And I would only see the picture, and then I would write it down what happened. And then I would get the sound the next time it was rebroadcast, or the other way around. And I would try to, I mean, it was, in a way, I was writing things down already, you know, because I had to match the picture to what they were saying. But I couldn't figure it out because it was one or the other. But I was so confused. You know, Gilligan's Island just confused me. I thought, you know, this is a rich, powerful country with this amazing navy. How could the millionaire and his wife not be rescued by now? They're such important people. Right. It was very confusing for me.
Is it true you decorated your bedroom to look like J.R. Ewing's office?
This is when we were a little wealthier. And I mean, when we were, you know, not lower class, but sort of middle class. And I was given a little bit of an allowance and everything. I just wanted it to look like J.R.'s office because the first thing that we watched religiously, my mother and I, was Dallas, you know, and so JR became a kind of hero. He was this, I was like all Soviets at that point, you know, a rampaging Republican, and so JR and his evil oil really appealed to me.
We need to take a break. When we return, we'll continue speaking with Gary Steingart. This is Ariel Gonzalez, and you're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Welcome back. This is Ariel Gonzalez, and you're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Our guest today is best-selling author Gary Steingart. Steingart is known for satirical novels, such as Absurdistan's Super Sad True Love Story, a recent bestseller. But his new book is a memoir about his life in his native Russia and in the United States. It's called Little Failure. You've mentioned in earlier segments about the political conservatism of Russian exiles. And it's understandable that exiles from a communist nation should embrace a conservative beliefs. Look at the Cubans in Miami. You adopted your parents' beliefs. What made you abandon them?
I mean, I have to say that in the community I grew up in, those beliefs were often tinged with some racism, you know, against blacks, Latinos. It was, you know, Ronald Reagan's welfare queen speeches and all that stuff. That was all a part of it. And I think part of it also was because we were immigrants to a foreign nation and people want to look down on someone because they feel so powerless themselves. And looking down at people who were even poorer than us was a part of growing up. But then I went to Stuyvesant High School, this sort of math and science high school in Manhattan, where everybody was from somewhere else. You know, everyone was Russian or Indian or Cuban or, you know, or Chinese or Korean. And I wasn't a very good student. I was not a great math and science student. So just meeting people who were smarter than me but happened not to be white or happened not to look like me sort of changed that part of it around. And then as I slowly became enamored of Manhattan and that world, I guess a much more liberal strain erupted in me. And then I ended up at Oberlin, and there was no point being a Republican over there, you know.
Well, what do you mean when you write in your memoir, the goal of politics is to make us children?
Well, I mean, one of the things I often was amazed me about Soviet emigres, you know, especially the men on some level that I met, older people, it seemed like a lot of them didn't progress past this kind of teenaged, it's almost like the political system conspired to keep people from knowing more, not just about the society around them, but about themselves. You know, there was a kind of ridiculous where, you know, you would get married at 21, you would have your kid at 23, and you'd be divorced at 25, and you'd be an alcoholic by 27, you'd be on your way out. You know, and the system kind of conspired to keep people in those straits. It's sometimes I hear people from the former Soviet Union, educated people, people with PhDs, you know, talk about their emotional life, and it just seems so stunted.
Well, you see that here in this country with some Americans. They also, some American, let's say, conservatives may have that same attitude.
Well, you know, without generalizing too much, it almost feels like there are blinkers on, and you can't look beyond certain things that you think are true, you know. So people will call, you know, any argument will bring up the Constitution or any sort of program that attempts to make other people have better access to education or medicine is always considered socialism. You know, there's certain mantras that are trotted out without any introspection, without understanding. There's very little. The Soviet Union did not imbue its citizens with empathy toward others. You lived only to advance yourself and the little group of people, your family around you. It was not an empathic society. It was a cruel society. And to this day, it remains so under Putin. There isn't really that much difference, you know.
Well, our guest today is Gary Steingart, whose new book is a memoir called Little Failure. You've mentioned Oberlin. This is a progressive college in Ohio. What was your life like there?
Well, that was interesting. You know, I showed up and I was, we were, I guess, middle class by then, but, you know, I grew up with my grandmother having food stamps and government cheese and all the good stuff. And all of a sudden I was surrounded by kids who were actually pretty well off, you know. And I noticed that some of them, for example, were wearing janitor's outfits. And I thought, wow, I guess just like me, they really have had to work their way up and into a place like Oberlin. But I didn't even understand that some of them were wealthy kids dressing ironically, you know, in that kind of Williamsburg, Brooklyn hipster way where you want to emphasize the fact that you're poor even when you're actually quite not poor. So it was a real education for me in the sense of understanding how wealthier people who would progress usually to working in places like the culture industries, people who would attend book parties that I would later attend, what it was like, what the things you had to say, the things you had to do. That was what the $100,000 I think paid for in tuition.
Yeah, you write that at Oberlin, Oberlin taught you to become a part of the culture industries in a handful of American cities. Yeah. So it's no good outside that.
Yeah.
Outside New York, San Francisco, LA, yeah. It's pointless.
It is completely pointless.
Yeah, no, you're not going to survive in Iowa. You're not going to survive.
Well, maybe the Iowa Writers' Workshop, but well, yeah, but that's about it. These little islands, you know, that exist. But I didn't know they existed. You know, when I went to Oberlin, my parents had a very clear-cut plan for me. They said, all right, look, you know, you can't get into an Ivy League school. You didn't do well enough at Stuyvesant. So do well at Oberlin, which was very easy, by the way. In my first class, you know, I had to watch Blade Runner and write a paper on it. So it wasn't like the advanced calculus I had to learn at Stuyvesant. But, you know, it was an education in how to fit in a very different milieu.
When did you start writing seriously?
At Oberlin. There was a professor there who was very wonderful named Diane Bruhls, and I said, you know, senior year, I said, I want to write a novel, you know, my first book, The Russian Debutante's Handbook. And she said, yeah, you're ready for it. Do it. And so I did it. And I wrote about the first half of it, or a little more was written during my senior year at Oberlin.
Well, some time ago, you participated in a conversation with Amy Hempel. Hempel writes very differently from you. She's a minimalist.
Yes.
Which means that she believes less is more.
Yes.
Would you call yourself a maximalist? Do you believe more is more?
Well, I think that as a writer, you need to know when it's enough or when it's not enough. You know, you're making a... I mean, some writers make a tangy bouillabaisse where every kind of sea animal imaginable is crammed in there and there's a thick, tangy stew. Other writers take a beautiful piece of fish and just add a little bit of olive oil and salt and just grill it very lightly. I love both dishes. You know, I'm not going to say that I prefer one to the other. But I am a bouillabaisse maker, not a you know, Greek-style grilled fish maker, if you have that, if we continue with that analogy. I have a lot of ingredients in my larder that I want to use. Do I admire writers like Amy Hempel? Of course. Raymond Carver, Amy Hempel. I mean, these are wonderful writers for whom less is more. But for me, I think more is more. Although I do want to play around with it a little bit. I mean, I think the use of satire peaked in a novel like Absurdistan. There was slightly less of it in Super Sad and True Love Story. And this memoir is... It's not a satirical memoir. I mean, there's humor in it, and hopefully it's not a depressing read. But at the same time, I didn't want to use the safety net of humor at all in this. I wanted to use humor only when it was deeply called for. And having very funny parents and a sort of tragicomic upbringing, it is called for in many times. So.
Well, after you graduated from Oberlin, you spiraled downward. Bad relationships, drugs, alcohol, a nervous breakdown. In Prague, you were beaten by skinheads, but that wasn't your fault. They just mistook you yeah. for an Arab.
Yeah. I was wearing this big Arab hat. That was not smart.
But you started therapy.
Yeah.
Did it help?
Yeah. I mean, I may be the last sort of proponent for therapy, for psychoanalysis, which is the Woody Allen school of, you know...
Let's not bring him up.
Yeah, I shouldn't bring him up.
He's probably a perfect example of therapy not helping.
But, you know, I didn't do a kind of Woody Allen analysis 5 times a week. That's crazy. I only did it 4 times a week. So I think I get a free pass on that one. And it's only been 12 years, so we're almost done. I think this is the last
year. Are you still in therapy?
Yeah, but we're almost done. I think the birth of this book, this memoir, which basically has a lot of the stuff that we went through in analysis, it's just been fine-tuned. The birth of a child. I just had a baby boy.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I think all of these markers are things that can be checked off as signs of, you know, some form of maturity. I mean, I'm 41, so it's a much delayed maturity.
But you have a stable life for the most
yes,
part.
Yes, I do now have a stable life. And all of the problems that you mentioned leading up to psychoanalysis, most of them have been taken care of. You mentioned a girlfriend. Actually, there's a Floridian aspect to that. An ex-girlfriend who attended the University of Florida. And then, this is a few years after we had broken up, she attacked someone who looked just like me, a kind of doppelganger, with a hammer at a bar in Gainesville. And she, I think, took off a piece of his ear. And she was in prison for a while and is still on parole. So there's a lovely Florida side to this story as well. I wasn't anywhere near Florida when this happened, but the person that she dated, people tell me anecdotally, kind of looked like me. So I guess she had a type.
You haven't spoken with her since?
I haven't spoken to her since, though.
I guess... Well, you should write about that. Well, you have written about
it's
that.
In there.
You
yeah.
did write
yeah,
about
yeah,
that.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, now you're in a very good place. You're in a very good marriage. You have, again, your child. You're a teacher at Columbia.
Yeah.
So now...
Everything's okay.
And after and hopefully after your parents read your memoir, if they don't come after you... Then you know you really have achieved closure.
Yes. If they don't sue me, we have closure.
Yeah, right? Hey, that's possible.
That's possible.
Okay, too. We need to take a break. When we return, we'll continue speaking with Gary Steingart. This is Eric Gonzalez, and you're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLON. Welcome back. This is Errol Gonzalez, and you're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLON. Our guest today is best-selling novelist Gary Steingart, who has been praised for novels such as Absurdistan and Super Sad True Love Story. But his new book is a memoir about his life in his native Russia and in the United States. It's called Little Failure. Gary, earlier I made note of the book trailer for your last novel, which can be seen on YouTube. It's very funny. You speak with a heavy accent, act like you're illiterate. The actor James Franco appears in the cameo. he took a creative writing course with you at Columbia. He's also in the trailer for your memoir. He plays your gay husband. Yes. Where did the idea for these trailers come from?
The first ones I came up with them myself. I just thought, you know, I'm so tired of being, you know, a writer as to go on stage and act, you know, act smart. So I decided, what if I was completely illiterate and I never learned how to speak English? I never learned how to read or write. And that became the series of trailers, first with Franco and then with Paul Giamatti. And the last one I came up with my editor, David Ebershoff, and we had the idea, you know, what if I was married to James Franco? And James, who is a wonderful sport, just went right with it. And, you know, we have a scene where we kiss, and that took like 67 different takes. And he was very, it was a lot of kissing going on. And he was very game to do it. He kisses a lot of people, you know, in his screen career. It was fun, you know. And in the trailer, which is, as you mentioned, on YouTube, I tell him that I can't believe that the publishers are going to call my memoir Little Failure. It's such an insult. And he said, well, you know, I've written a book about the two of us, and it's called 50 Shades of Gary. And I tell him, I can't believe you have a memoir coming out. When I have a memoir coming out, he said, you know, and he says, it's not a memoir, it's an erotic homage. And so that leads to all kinds of hair ruffling and other sexual stuff.
Well, speaking of gay marriage, I have to ask you about this Russian obsession with homophobia.
Okay.
What do they have against gays?
You know, I think that the regime always has to villainize someone. You know, that's always been the case. So they always, they look for people that are despised, or with Jews, it was always a group that's been historically despised. So it was very easy to say, all right, let's go after Jews, because you can unite the population against that. That's why anti-Semitism flourished so much in the Soviet Union. With gays, it was a little different, because I think outside of Moscow, Petersburg, a couple of big cities, there really isn't gay life to speak of. I mean, it's always been, it exists perhaps, but no, you know, you ask an average Russian, how many gay people do you know? And they'll probably say none, you know. But Putin realized, and at different levels of government, they realized, okay, now we can villainize somebody. We can all gather together around this, and so we can, you know, we can pass laws that seem patriotic, but there are all these ridiculous homophobic laws. And they passed overwhelmingly, even in cities like St. Petersburg, my hometown, which is such an overwhelmingly liberal city by Russian standards. So I think this, and then Putin, you know, he had to sort of, with the Sochi Olympics, which is his, you know, his big event, I think they were maybe a little surprised by just how internationally this outburst of homophobia was condemned. So
it got out of hand.
It got out of hand, you know. So they stopped pushing it as much as they did. And, you know, Putin said, of course, gays are welcome in Sochi and everyone can be gay in Sochi and et cetera, et cetera. But look, it's a very, you know, people may disagree with this, but it is, I think, at heart, a very conservative society and one that has been shielded for so long from the Renaissance, from all kinds of other European phenomena. I mean, this was first the Mongols, the Tatars swept in, and they kept the whole country isolated geographically and otherwise from all the stuff that was happening in Europe after the Middle Ages. Then you had the Soviet Union, you know, which was the Iron Curtain, which also kept the population to the point where basic psychological terms aren't even understood by most Russians. Not, you know, whatever you think of Freud, those concepts have penetrated our society. We know, we know what stuff like, what transference is, what closure means, things like that. But a lot of that is only beginning to catch on in Russia. So the country's 70 years behind in that sense. And that's why, I mean, I think, look, I don't think there's inherently a kind of homophobic attitude in Russia versus other countries. But I think the way the country's been isolated and the way the regime has played the homophobic card, it will take a while, a long while, for it to catch up to other parts of Europe.
We're speaking with Gary Steingart about his memoir, Little Failure. What do you think about the Sochi Olympics? People are going through a hard time in Russia, and Putin's government has spent a fortune on it.
This is my, on a sports level, this is my 41st year of not caring at all about the Winter Olympics. I just don't care. I mean, the only sport I even vaguely enjoy is swimming and maybe some badminton here and there. So on that level, I don't care. But yes, it's a $50 billion waste of money. Half of it probably stolen, corruption, various cronies of Putin made out like bandits. And the fact that it's going into this area right next to this huge, it's a war zone practically, Dagestan, Chechnya, all these different republics.
All the terrorist threats.
All these terrorists, but you know, that $50 billion could have been spent in those surrounding areas making life better for people. But that's not how Russia or the Soviet Union has ever worked. It's always these grandiose projects that are supposed to make the leader and the country look good in front of an international audience. That's all it's ever been.
Those five-year plans.
And the funny thing is, I love following Sochi, not the games themselves, but the way they've been constructed. It's all shoddy construction and everyone's skimmed off the top. It's like, you know, it's like the Sopranos giving the Olympics to the cast of the Sopranos on HBO. You know, that's basically all it is.
Because in essence, isn't Russia an oligarchy right now?
It's an oligarchy. It's a kleptocracy where a very small, tiny, tiny stretch of the population just skims all the money. You know, I remember a couple of years ago, was it the Four Seasons in Miami Beach? One of those sort of hotels in the Intercontinental, or the Four Seasons. It's on a little island off of Key Biscayne, maybe around there. Mm-hmm. I was sitting there and by the pool, that's this beautiful infinity pool. And I was watching all these Russians playing card games. And you knew they had just gotten off the plane in Moscow, just checked into their luxury suites. They're a worldwide presence, and it's really amazing, you know.
And their parents or they themselves used to be perhaps diehard communists.
Oh, of course. Yeah. Of course. I mean, not 100%. I mean, some of them are young enough that they grew up, maybe they were part of the Komsomol Youth League, and maybe some of them wanted to be party members. But a lot of them also grew up in that transitional period where, you know, where Glasnost was just getting going, and you know, things were ripe for the stealing. You could, companies were being nationalized for pennies on the dollar, kopecks on the ruble, and they were smart enough. I mean, you have to be clever enough to know when to buy, and they were. And now they're enjoying quite a good life.
You're a big fan of the Russian playwright and short story writer Anton Chekhov. Vladimir Nabokov said about Chekhov that he wrote sad stories for humorous people. Your humor mixes comedy and tragedy. Like Chekhov, do you write sad stories for humorous people?
Well, or conversely, I write humorous tales for sad people. When this book came out, you know, I've been doing a lot of touring, and some of it has been very sad in a sense. You know, there was people come up to me who have had very similar experiences to mine, a very difficult assimilation in this country. Parents who mean well, but who pressure them so much that they don't know what to do. You know, they have their parents want them to be one thing, but their soul lies elsewhere. There was a reader who came to me at a signing in New York, and a Russian woman, very young, and she said, could you sign this book to, quote, a little failure / unemployed paralegal? And my heart just broke for her. And I thought, my God, I said to her, do whatever you feel you need to do. You know, I know it's so hard because your parents do mean well for you. But they do say these very difficult, cutting things because they think that will push you to become a better person, but it won't.
Well, there was a memoir that was another memoir that was a big bestseller last year by Amy Chua, Battle Cry of the Tiger Mom, which I absolutely hated because for me, your memoir is the anti-Tiger Mom.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you're familiar with it, of course.
Of course.
She says, no, push your kids, drive them into the ground, and they will flourish.
Oh, those poor kids.
Yeah. I sometimes think, what's going to happen to her kids in 10 or 15 years?
Well, sometimes you read interviews with them, with one of them in particular, and she does seem to be rebelling against that kind of, I mean, I don't want to put words in her mouth, but look, you know, there is too much indulgence that happens in America sometimes. Some parents just, you know, their kid is the best and is so special and is number one no matter what she or he does. And that drives me bananas. But there has to be a happy medium as well, you know. You can't push your kid to be something she or he is not. You just can't. I mean, you can provide examples of what works for you. And if those kids want to follow those examples, God bless them. But, you know, I mean, I love my kid, but I don't... If he chooses a different path for me, not just in terms of career, I hope he doesn't choose a different path, but if he decides, you know, politically he doesn't want to follow my footsteps, God bless. We all have our journey, and that's the wonderful thing about life.
Thank you for coming in. We've been speaking with Gary Steingart.
Ariel Gonzalez is an English professor at Miami-Dade College. You can see his reviews and blog on the Huffington Post. He also reviews books for the Miami Herald and, of course, interviews authors for Topical Currents. And that does wrap up today's Topical Currents. Thank you so much for joining us. Our producer is Richard Ives, with technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. We have free audio archives and downloads from our website, WLRN.org, including today's program. And more information and links at the Topical Currents Facebook page. That's at facebook.com/topicalcurrents. Tomorrow's program features an encore presentation of a program with Jacqueline Chido. She is the founder of Elder Care of Florida, Inc. She had a 30-year career in the banking industry as a corporate fiduciary. She now serves as a professional private trustee, guardian, and home care manager. Please tune in. And I'm Bonnie Berman, Joseph Cooper still on vacation, hoping you enjoy your Earth Day. Please stay tuned for Here and Now, up next from NPR News.